Welcome to the Danger Zone. I am your host, Jim Two, and here at the Santa Cruz Voice.com and KSCO.com's podcast alley. Today is May 29th, 2026, the year of our Lord, as I am recording this old podcasto. And I was thinking, you know, what theme can we unite? What do all these stories have in common? And maybe the theme would be, we won't be fooled again, right? Or question mark, as the case may be, because there's been a lot of fraud of stuff going on. And the question is, you know, are we collectively going to be fooled? There's always, you know, whenever there's some sort of mass hysteria or something that goes on that most people fall for, there's at least a couple people that don't fall for the fraud. Either A, they're extremely perceptive, or just they're just one of those contrarian type people that kind of go against whatever everyone else is doing. And so they didn't detect the scam, as opposed to they just, you know, didn't want to go with the crowd, and they're just normally, you know, contrarian. But anyways, so will we fall for the scam again? And I think this first step of whether or not we will be fooled again is to at least acknowledge when we were fooled. And so here from the Stack O' Stuff, one from the Washington Free Beacon, exclusive: U.S. probe of embattled UN Gaza relief agency expands to 1,500 staffers suspected of Hamas ties. UNRWA could soon be labeled a foreign terrorist organization. So the first potential scam is that the UN Relief Works Agency, I think it's what R stands for, pretended to help refugees. But the scam was they weren't helping refugees, they were aiding Hamas terrorists. This is by Adam Credo, May 28. The federal investigation into staff at the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, the UN Gaza Relief Organization that's been closely linked to Hamas, will soon encompass at least 1,500 UNRWA-linked individuals suspected of terror ties. This unprecedented dragnet, reported here for the first time by the Washington Free Beacon, exposes an aid group brimming with Hamas operatives and is generating momentum in Congress and the Trump administration for harsher sanctions on the embattled aid group, according to the congressional staffers briefed on the matter. The punitive measures up for consideration include stripping the UNRWA of its diplomatic immunity under U.S. law, which would open up to legal action from terror victims, and fully designating the aid organization as a foreign terrorist organization, according to three Trump administration officials and other sources tracking the matter in Congress. These discussions have accelerated since the Free Beacon first reported in April that the UNRWA and other UN agencies are stonewalling a federal probe into their ties to Hamas. The UN Agency for International Development Inspector General's Office, a law enforcement agency separate from the largely defunct USAID, has spent months independently unearthing evidence that multiple UNRWA employees participated in Hamas's October 7 terror attack. The probe will soon expand to at least 1,500 suspected militants with UNRWA ties. So, the people that were supposed to defend these poor refugee people or whatever was actually assisting Hamas in their terror attack on October 7th. You know, the killing, the raping, the beheading of infant babies. What was it? Raping Jewish women in so badly until their pelvic bones were shattered, and they paraded their unconscious and or dead and recently raped bodies on video. I mean, that's the weird thing. It's like you could make up stuff like Hamas did about alleged IDF atrocities, and there's no corroborating evidence. Now, and you can say, oh, you know, the IDF and the Jews are doing the same thing to the innocent Palestinians or the Hamas people. But the crazy thing is, on October 7th, the Hamas operatives, terrorists, as the case may be, actually filmed themselves doing these things too. Their victims, and put it on streaming. They streamed it live on the internet. So yeah. So, and here's the thing: the UNRWA is a organization that is within the ambit of the United Nations. So could the United Nations itself be a terrorist organization? Something, I guess, Ambassador Waltz could go ask them in the next General Assembly or Security Council meeting. So, yeah, why are they so hot and heavy to defend a terrorist organization? That's another unresolved question. I'm assuming it's something along the lines of, well, they see the lens through colonial, oppressor and oppressed, and therefore the Jews are the oppressor and the Hamas terrorists are the oppressed, as the case may be. But, you know, but so that's the first thought. The second, there's some more other little tidbits or tips of a big iceberg, so to speak, of fraud that is our federal government. Well, and I would like to think that even my progressive friends would agree that there's a lot of fraud going on in the federal government. We might disagree as to where it's occurring. I would say it's a little bit of everywhere, but they probably would focus more on national defense. And, I'm sure there's probably a little fraud and waste going on in national defense. But at least with national defense, you get righteous butt kicking like we got in Venezuela and now we're getting in Iran. Whereas here, you're just in their programs that they kind of defend, they're just making themselves rich and not doing anybody any good. So here is from the New York Post. Minnesota pair bilked $21 million in state funds meant for autism services, /feds, by Patrick Riley, May 28. Two Minnesota fraudsters allegedly swindled more than $21 million in funding earmarked for autism services through two bogus companies and then spent it lavishly on overseas property, officials said. Shamso Ahmed Hassan, 55, and Hanan Mursal Youssef, 25, whose mugshots were released on Wednesday, made off like bandits by submitting millions of dollars in fake claims to Minnesota's Early Intensive Development and Behavioral Intervention Program, EDBI, God, that's a terrible acronym, between May 2020 and December 2024, authorities said. The pair enrolled two companies co-owned by Hassan, Smart Therapy Center LLC and Star Autism Center LLC, as service providers to submit claims and were secured $21.2 million in funds aimed at helping people under 21 with autism. The swindlers were part of an extensive scheme to use stolen money for them, on themselves and their families, including buying property in Kenya and a truck. Okay. I hope it's more property, because if they bought a truck with this, I'm hoping it's not, that might be one heck of an expensive truck. But anyways, Hassan and her employee Youssef, who live together and are both U.S. citizens, remain in federal custody pending court proceedings, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Their arrests are part of a larger fraud scheme that totaled more than $46 million and included two other defendants, Asha Farhan Hassan, 28, and Abdinajab Hassan Youssef, 27, who appear to be siblings. Both previously took plea deals tied to their involvement in the scams at Star Autism and Smart Therapy. That's interesting. Anyway, so, here's a weird thing is, like, I think Benny Johnson was pointing this out on his podcast, is that, you have a chart as to the rate of autism in the United States, and, starting from maybe the mid 80s or whatever, was relatively low. And then starting in maybe the mid to early 1990s, it started going up a bit. And he opined that, what happened since then? After Mogadishu or whatever in the Clinton administration, they apparently let in a whole bunch of Somali migrants in the United States. And that seemed to correlate with the spike in autism cases. I find that a bit, I don't necessarily think there's a causal connection between the two, but if there is a correlation, that is interesting. But FYI, if you Google it on the internet, the average IQ in Somalia is around 70. So is it because the tests are biased, or is it because all these people are fraudulently claiming that their kids are autistic? Who knows? But now you might think, that's only $21 million. But the thing is, there are a whole bunch of other programs, bunch of them, which Nick Shirley exposed. And he probably only got just the tip of that iceberg in Minnesota. And, people are like, you're targeting these people of color or whatever. It's like, given that there's been several dozen actual convictions or guilty pleas in Minnesota, right? So you're not talking about some racist jury pool that hates people of color. You're talking, you know, the very people that are welcoming these said people of color, who basically found that, you know, there's been a lot of fraud going on. You know, the only question is, how much is there, right? And I'm betting it's a lot, because here's another item on the stack of stuff. This is by Anthony Rubin of muckraker.org. So this might be true, this may not be true. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. May 27. I got this from zerohedge.com. Food stamp fraud pipeline exposed. U.S. taxpayer-funded groceries shipped overseas and sold for profit. Food stamps and food pantries are intended to keep struggling Americans fed. I don't think anyone disputes that, right? What we found is that in some communities, that food never reaches an American table. Instead, it gets shipped overseas and sold for profit. The scheme works like this. Residents in cities like Lawrence, Massachusetts, collect food through two channels, purchasing it at local markets using EBT cards and picking it up for free from food banks and churches. That food is then packed in large blue barrels, dropped off at shipping companies, and sent by container ship to the Dominican Republic. Once it arrives, it is sold for profit at local stores. The people doing this see nothing wrong with it. In many cases, they do it openly. According to a local that assisted us with the story, this fraud has been happening for over a decade. Over a decade, that's a long time. Over the course of several weeks, the Muckraker Foundation traced the full pipeline from food pantry lines in Lawrence, Massachusetts, through shipping warehouses in New York, to store shelves in Santo Domingo. This is what we found. I'm assuming Santo Domingo is in the Dominican Republic. Yeah, but then again, I'm an American, so my knowledge of geography is only based on places where America's invaded. Let's see here. Lawrence, Massachusetts, is a small city about 30 miles north of Boston. It has the highest concentration of Dominican immigrants in any city of Massachusetts, and the highest rate of SNAP enrollment in the state. Now, for all you old fuddy-duddies, SNAP is another way of saying food stamps. Oh, yeah, that's the new way of saying food stamps. But anyways, John has been delivering goods in Lawrence over 11 years, 6 days a week, 35 stops a day. He knows the community intimately. Quote, I've been witnessing Dominican residents going to the food bank lines and collecting non-perishable goods, he told us, and then packing it in barrels and in boxes, and then they ship it back to the Dominican Republic. We asked him how he knew the food was being purchased with food stamps. Quote, some of them have openly told me and my wife that that's what they're doing, he said. And then the other way is the math. The math is straightforward. A 50-pound bag of rice costs $30 in Lawrence. The same bag costs $35 in the Dominican Republic. Add shipping, and the economics makes no sense unless the food was free or paid for with government benefits. Yeah, if you're getting that 50-pound bag of rice for free, you're paying about $5 for shipping, so to speak, or whatever, you know. $30 of pure profit is pretty good. John drove us to the streets of Lawrence and showed us evidence hiding in plain sight. Blue shipping barrels stacked outside of corner stores for sale. Not one store, not two, store after store after store. These barrels aren't trash cans, John said. They're being used to ship the product. Every one of those stores also advertised prominently that they accept EBT. EBT is electronic benefit transactions or whatever. It's like a debit card that you can use to purchase food through the food stamp program or the SNAP program. Abigail also worked in Lawrence in 2011. She asked us not to disclose her profession, but her job takes her inside people's homes on a daily basis. I'm assuming that's a maid, but you know, could be wrong. Or maybe just a burglar. Anyways. Quote, many of them will have large boxes, large bins in their apartments full of food that they give out at the pantries here, she told us. And when I asked them what it's for, they say they mail it back so it can either be given to their families there or be sold in the bodegas there. We asked if these patients knew what they were doing something wrong. No, she said, and laughed quietly. They feel entitled. They feel like that's what we come here for. Yep. Ah, that's the American dream. Come here and collect welfare, but free stuff. We asked how widespread she believed the fraud would be amongst the patients she visits. Oh, patients. So maybe she's a hospice worker. I don't know. About half the people I've seen. Yeah. So could there be some fraud going on? Could it be more widespread than we think? That's a federal program. Yeah. SNAP. Is food stamps. But anyways, this is from a press release from the White House, May 26th. Trump's administration full-scale war on fraud. President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance are unleashing unrelenting full-scale assault on fraudsters, scammers, and corrupt operators who have looted billions from American taxpayers. The White House Task Force to Eliminate Fraud is moving at unprecedented speed and ferocity to root out waste, abuse, criminal exploitation of government programs that have drained billions from hardworking government taxpayers. This direct offensive against fraudulent scheme preying on hardworking Americans, the results are already staggering. Here are some of the task force key actions and victories to date. So remember, it's only been about a year and change or whatever. So February 26, $260 million in Medicaid payments in Minnesota for rampant fraud allegations. I'm assuming that's the, you know, that could be the medical transport thing, demanding full cooperation from federal investigators. March 19, federal prosecutors charged 11 individuals in major real estate and loan fraud preying on elderly Americans in California. No amount given. March 25th, Trump administration suspended dozens of high-risk hospice and home health care providers in the Los Angeles area. Remember, the, you know, Dr. Oz cruising around Glendale? March 30, Trump administration launched new national fraud whistleblower program to empower Americans, expose waste and abuse. Okay, yeah, meh. April 2nd, the Trump administration suspended hundreds of additional high-risk hospice and home health care providers across California. You notice, you don't see many stories from in Southern California about all these honest hospice providers, you know, playing the sob stories about how they got cut off from Medicaid or Medicare or whatever, and how, you know, you see any news footage of people dying? But anyways, hang on for a moment. I got to do something for a moment here. And let's see, what else is here listed here? I think the big one was the Small Business Administration basically found $22 billion of fraudulent loans. So, you know, if you add this all up, this is, you know, if you, this is, what date is the White House press release? May 26th. So if you add this all up, it's about $30 billion. Now, that's an interesting, that is an interesting start, right? We, you know, our budget deficit is about $1.9 trillion. $30 billion is a nice start, but, you know, we still got a ways to go. And this has only been for the year since they started this task force and Nick Shirley. You throw in whatever Doge found, which is about, I think about $200 billion. Not bad. But again, we still have plenty of ways to go. So let's see here. What else is, well, this is one of those like stories that, if you had told me this in isolation, I'd be sitting here going, you're really pulling my leg. Or as I'm often want to say, the internet must be trolling me. But this is from cityjournal.org. Christopher Rufo, Austin Hufford. California is giving free solar panels to illegal aliens. May 26, California spending millions of dollars on a program that provides free solar panels, refrigerators, and windows to low-income farm workers, including illegal immigrants. The initiative, called the Farm Worker Housing Component of the Low-Income Weatherization Program, man, that's a mouthful, is part of California's sprawling multi-billion-dollar cap-and-trade system, which taxes carbon producers and redistributes approximately $3 billion per year to energy programs and left-wing social causes under the banner of fighting climate change. Yeah, well, if you've listened to my previous podcast, you know where at least $1 billion of that $3 billion a year goes. That's the high-speed rail. But let's see how much goes to this particular program. Since 2019, California's government has earmarked $49 million for the Farm Worker Program, which operates through an opaque web that includes a government agency, nonprofit providers, and private contractors. California's Department of Community Services and Development selected La Cooperativa Campesina de California, sorry about that, a nonprofit that serves farm workers, to administer the program. La Capu Cooperativa, in turn, has partnered with a for-profit minority-owned company, Maroma Energy Services, to help run the program. Contractors do the work of installing solar panels and other appliances. These organizations have heavily advertised the program to California's nearly 900,000 agricultural workers, on behalf of three-quarters of whom are illegal immigrants. In its official documentation, California's Department of Community Services and Development acknowledges that non-citizens are eligible for the program, and they may even accept identification from foreign governments. In the Spanish language radio podcast broadcast, Natalie Velorges, a program manager for Moroma, confirmed that participants do not need legal status in the United States and can use matricula consular, a form of identification that Mexican consul provides to migrants who have crossed over the border to apply. Quote, we only require an ID, Velorges said. It doesn't need to be from the state or the United States. Defendant fisheries work hard to loop laborers into the system. A contractor for John Harrison Contracting, a California-based minority-owned business enterprise and farm worker housing component subcontractor, would drive hundreds of miles a day across Southern California trying to persuade farm workers to sign up for the program. Insight Climate News previously reported. One challenge, this is the good part, was to convince the workers that the program was not a scam. The other challenge after the Trump administration increased ICE raids was finding potential clients, many of whom stopped showing up at job sites. Okay. All right. The latter I can understand, right? But I mean, the first part is like, even the illegal immigrants are sitting going, nah. It's hilarious. I mean, here's the thing that probably would irk me as a California resident and U.S. citizen is that I can't afford to buy a home in California. How many illegal alien migrant farm workers can afford a home to put solar panels in or, you know, to buy appliances for? I mean, come on, man. If I'm a migrant farm worker and I'm quote unquote undocumented, right? What are the chances I own a home? More likely than not, you're renting and, you know, you're probably having, you know, your landlord is providing the appliances. But so what are the odds that this is just one giant scam for these NGOs to, you know, funnel money to, you know, these for-profit corporations and skim some money off for themselves? I think it's pretty good. I think it's pretty high. This could be potentially fraudulent. You know, don't want to make accusations. I don't know for sure. Maybe there are really good farm workers who are really, really productive at what they do and they figure out ways to make money and buy a home that me as an American citizen, because I'm not as creative or as innovative as they are, haven't figured out. But anyways, let's see. But moving on, this is a slightly off, fraud adjacent, so to speak. This is not everything appears as it appears to be level of fraud, as opposed to just the rip you off kind of fraud that we've been talking about. Hassan Piker names pro-CCP tycoon Singham as financier political movements despite nonprofit veneer. This is by Ashra Nomani, Fox News, May 26. A far-left political influencer Hassan Piker identified American Marxist tech tycoon Neville Roy Singham as a major financier behind the network of pro-communist U.S. nonprofits engaged in political advocacy and a lot of political movements, making the first public acknowledgement from a figure inside the far-left network that organizations in the Singham network are operating with explicitly political agenda. No. The comments are significant because congressional investigators and watchdog groups have long argued that nonprofits connected to Singham are functioning as overt political operations while enjoying tax-exempt charitable status. Critics argue such activity may violate nonprofit tax laws, which place strict limits on the amount of political activities charities can conduct. As Fox News Digital reported exclusively on Saturday, Treasury Department's official Office of Foreign Assets Control issued an administrative subpoena to Piker and far-left Code Pink co-founder Susan Medea Benjamin for possibly violating sanctions against doing business with the Communist Party of Cuba when they traveled to the island nation in March for an ideologically charged transnational convergence of communists in the international convoy. Piker and Benjamin haven't responded to press or comments, but they have publicly defended their trips as humanitarian missions to help the people of Cuba. About 37 minutes in a 6-hour live stream on Monday, Feds are after me, punctuated but with two cursing emojis. Piker stunned listeners knowledgeable about the intricacies of far-left networks by saying that he believes federal investigators are ultimately targeting Singham and organizations he supports, including Code Pink and the self-declared communist organizations Answer Coalition and the Party for Socialism and Liberation, for the political work they do. Together, these groups and other of the Singham network have organized, coordinated, and staffed the most divisive anti-U.S. street protests the nation has seen in the past decade. Party for Socialism and Liberation is called PSL by far-left activists. I quote, I think that ultimately the target is probably Singham and his operation or PSL to answer correlation with Code Pink like anything that he has ever financed, Piker said during the stream. Yeah, that's possible. Now, the rub is, you know, is that somehow a violation of American law in the sense that if Singham is actually being sponsored by a foreign government, say China, is that a, is there a violation of law there, or is it just the general, you know, free speech protections that everyone's, you know, you could oppose your government, you know, First Amendment allows you to express opposition to, you know, whatever your government does type of thing, or is it actual working for a foreign agent that has hostile intent to the United States in violation of a federal law? That's going to be the interesting question. I don't necessarily know, but it depends on what the facts, you know, will uncover, I would say. This is, in addition to interesting stuff, so is there potentially fraud in the sense that these supposed grassroots organizations are actually astroturfed from foreign money and billionaires like Neville Roy Singham? Could it be that all these NGOs that are posing as nonprofit groups and trying to be charitable are actually foreign agents or dupes of foreign interests that are trying to undermine and cause chaos and tumult in our country? I don't know. Here's a, here's an interesting one. Part of the network of people who seem to hate the America, we're now apparently agitating against AI data centers being built in the U.S. And Kevin O'Leary, you know, was talking about this, and he was informed by his people that there is something nefarious possibly going on with a coordinated campaign to oppose these AI data centers. And they're not grassroots in the sense. They are astroturfed. Here is what he, Kevin O'Leary, had to say.
I have another mission that has emerged from this that I did not see coming. And maybe we want to segue into what happened the evening of May 4th at 8:30, because I have 12 million plus followers on various social media platforms. I got a call from one of our IT guys, and he said, there's something wrong here. There's a massive influx in DMs going on two specific platforms, X, formerly Twitter, and Instagram. Not a small increase, tens of thousands of percent increase. I said, well, is it a mistake? Is there a technical glitch on these platforms? He said, unlikely. They're two different complete platforms. So he had a first look, and he said, wow, there's a lot of similar IP addresses here. And so we did an initial scan, and we realized, wait a second, there is bots operating here. There are nefarious accounts out of the country dumping stuff that's completely false about Utah. So we didn't wait. The next morning we hired and started working with a very advanced data science team. And what we learned was, to me, shocking, just stunning. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I still can't, because I'm getting the data by the 4-hour cycle now. The content itself was coming from two batches, like the actual pixels, the images, were from the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the People's Dispatch. I'd never heard of them before. You do a search on them, you'll find them under investigation by multiple branches of Congress. Most of the within the IP addresses in Utah were coming from two IP addresses, Alliance for a Better Utah and one called Elevate. So we found out that Alliance for a Better Utah was actually a tax filer. And we went to the IRS Form 990s, which are public. And we started to drill down into what the filings were. And lo and behold, multiple filings through multiple entities all over the world, all going back to something called Arabella. Neville Singham, under investigation, multiple branches of the government. shares offices with the CPP. So then I said, I want more. Can you tell me the exact amounts? And we got those the next day. We're talking about millions, hundreds of millions of dollars here.
Yep. I think he means CCP, not CPP. That'd be the Chinese Communist Party for you wine moms in Capitola. But yeah, so why is Neville Roy Singham and the CCP and the Arab Belt, you know, funding these or, you know, associated with these NGOs, so to speak, that are, you know, almost uniformly opposing, almost seems like everything that might be good in the United States and pushing everything that's bad, at least for my humble opinion, as the case may be. Could it be that there is a coordinated effort sponsored by some foreign entities to disrupt, possibly overthrow the United States government or, you know, wreck our country? Yeah, you know, sounds a little McCarthyite. Then again, and we, after 4 years of being accused of being a Russian spy under the Trump administration's first term and the Joe Biden administration, maybe it's just projection coming true, so to speak, from our progressive friends that called us Russian agents. Maybe they were the ones that were the foreign-influenced ones. But anyways, more on the potential fraud stack o stuff here. This is from The Hill. Judge clears way for Trump mail-in ballot executive order by Ashley Fields, May 28. Federal judge on Thursday cleared the way for President Trump's March executive order beefing up rules surrounding mail-in ballots to stand in the face of legal challenges from Democrats. The order would require the federal government to establish a list of eligible voters based on available citizenship data and direct the U.S. Postal Service to only deliver mail-in ballots to individuals on each state's approved voter roll. District Judge Carl Nichols, in his ruling, said the lawsuit brought by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, NAACP, and League of United Latin American Citizens is unlikely to succeed on the merits and is largely speculative. The plaintiffs argued Trump's order violates the Privacy Act by creating a list of individuals who are citizens and over the age of 18 in an attempt to establish an inventory of eligible voters based on federal data, even if no information is ever transmitted to any state. They also alleged the order treads on states' constitutional authority over elections. However, Nichols said the argument will only stand if a purely intra-federal government list is created. But plaintiffs failed to demonstrate that such action, that is, the sharing of name, age, and residence information between and among government agencies, if already known to the federal government, would cause a harm sufficient to bring the lawsuit. The judge also rejected the argument that there's a serious risk that Democrat voters are more likely to be erroneously left off state citizenship lists than Republicans, and that they therefore face burdens on their ability to vote. The federal judge said injury again rests on highly attenuated chain of possibilities. His ruling comes as Trump and the GOP fight to maintain his majority in both chambers of Congress. The president has pressed lawmakers to push through the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, which would require proof of citizenship to register to vote ahead of midterm elections. Next week, U.S. Judge Indira Talwani, an appointee of former President Obama, is set to hear arguments on the Trump mail-in ballot restrictions in case brought by Democrat states in Boston, according to Reuters. Early this year, Trump voted by mail in the Florida special election. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so I'm going to guess that the judge in Boston is going to rule opposite of this particular judge. Just to guess. I'm speculating, but, you know, if I'm wrong, you know, feel free to let me know. I would be pleasantly surprised, and I'd be happy if I'm wrong, and that the judge rules, and that both judges rule the same way, and no mail-in ballots will go to people who are not, you know, listed in the federal database at the address where they claim to be in the postal database. Can you imagine? You know, I mean, Democrat voters, and well, all voters would actually be required to, you know, go to the polling booth to actually cast a vote or to actually, you know, use an address where they actually receive their U.S. mail. I mean, heaven forbid that, you know, someone who isn't listed at the post office at a particular address actually gets a ballot sent to that address. In fact, my suspicion, and again, this is all I'm speculating, is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, they'll live someplace and they register with the state registrar's office at where they're living. And then at some point in the future, you know, they'll vote or whatever, but then they move, right? They'll move to, you know, move to some other county, some other state or whatever, and they'll register at those, at that place. But they don't unregister at the place they used to live in. So maybe, so I'm assuming a good chunk of voter rolls in any county might have a certain percentage of people who used to live there, but no longer live there, right? And in past, in the past, it was no problem because, you know, A, you know, they wouldn't, you know, if you moved, you wouldn't show up to your old voting place and vote, right? Because you moved, right? Or even if you tried it, you know, you have to show ID and then your ID would show a different address and, well, you, you know, there you go. And, you know, why would you, you could theoretically get a, you know, absentee ballot, but that would require you to, normally would have required you to apply for an absentee ballot. But now they just mail you a ballot, even if you didn't ask for an absentee ballot or whatever. Anybody who lives there can just fill in your thing and send it in. So, and that is what the executive order is going to stop, is, you know, to stop zombie voters from voting. And, you know, who knows what percentage of a voter roll in any particular jurisdiction are zombie voters, right? People who've died, people who've moved to another state or location or whatever, are voting someplace else. But in a really close election, it could make a difference. But anyways, so, you know, but again, why Democrats would oppose this, well, you know, you hear their reasons, and I think it's bologna sausage, but hey, you know, that's just me. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, this is related to the Joe Biden little fraud. Because remember, for 4 years, Democrats in the mainstream media were telling you Joe Biden, it was not senile. He was totally there. And these little slips, oh, because he had a stuttering problem. No. Or, you know, he had a cold that day, or he didn't have good sleep that night or whatever, right? They were trying to gaslight us into thinking that Joe Biden was, oh, he behind the scenes, he's wearing out aides that are half his age or something, or third of his age or something like that, right? No, that was a gigantic fraud. Here are a couple of stories that indicate why. This is from townhall.com. Here's what Joe Biden told Jill after he got wrecked by Trump in that disastrous debate by Matt Vespa, May 28. Former First Lady, author of the book about her time in the White House. It's not a tell-all. It's quite the opposite. It's reportedly filled with details about how navigating the complexity of East-wing politics, as the Atlantic noted. For once, it wasn't filled with fake news or questionable anonymous sources. Jill felt the need to clarify some of the issues, especially about her husband's disastrous debate performance against Donald Trump on CNN on June of 2024, which sealed his fate. It would be the final chapter in a somewhat unremarkable political career, public career capped by a failed presidency. We know what he said as Jill led him off the stage. Quote, I really effed up, didn't I? Joe said at the time. Jill was blunt in her response. Yes, you did. If the book won't resolve the tense relationship the family has with the Democrat Party overall, which is still upset for pushing Joe off the, which they still resent for pushing Joe off the 2024 ticket. Really? Ninja, please. They still believe that Joe Biden could have beaten Trump, even though everything points to a loss similar to Kamala Harris' experience or worse. Seeing him appear mentally unsteady on stage and then contracting COVID only made the story worse, and Jill didn't clear things up either. In fact, she only added more confusion, like not being able to say whether Joe took Ambien or cough syrup than to fight a developing cold. Biden said he wasn't feeling well the night of the debate. Did she even ask? Well, we're about to learn that Jill was, for Joe, taking a cognitive test for quiet critics, but was overruled by her husband's dollar store advisors. Which is it, Jill? Was Joe having a stroke? Or are you trying to gaslight us? The rally the next day was sort of kills the attempt. The second route the record straight as she made it worse. You know, so I think we have a clip here, if I could find it here in my stack of stuff, of the notorious clip here. Let's see here. Where was it?
With the COVID, excuse me, with dealing with.
As I watched it, I thought, oh my God, he's having a stroke.
Joe, you did such a great job. You answered every question. You knew all the facts.
Yeah. So, you know, so basically she told CBS, that's this clip from CBS, when Joe made that answer, we beat Medicare, that she thought he was having a stroke. Yet the next day, as played by that clip, Joe, you answered every question that was asked of you. Like, as if that was like an accomplishment. Like, I mean, most people, when you ask them questions, you'll answer the question. You know, the answer may not be right, but you at least answered the question. So, so she was either lying now, or she was lying then, or she was lying both times, as the case may be. Because the thing is, we have all the postmortems from the campaign that books came out about the 2020 election, where Jill and the Biden family were telling people, right after that debate, and you know, even up to the debate, you know, Joe was fine. Joe's totally fine. He just had a cold. He was really tired. He didn't get enough sleep or whatever. And what people forget is that, you know, he had come back from the NATO summit, you know, where he, you know, kind of walked away from the group, you know, after some, you know, paragliders or whatever. The Italian prime minister had to, like, you know, come go get him like a wayward child or whatever. He was like, but you know, he came back from that summit. He was not making any public appearances for a whole week. He was preparing for that debate for a whole week. So we had a whole week to, you know, rest up, get ready, get tanned, get relaxed, or on the flip side, you know, practice, study, you know, whatever, shoot him up with whatever drugs that would keep him, that made him appear to be, you know, lucid when he wasn't. But you know, hey, you know, so yeah, I mean, you know, she's totally full of bologna sausage. And I share Stephen Cruiser's sentiment here at PJ Media, shared yesterday, May 28th. The morning briefing, the Bidens really need to shut up and go away. Yeah, and that's pretty much it. I mean, let's see here. Hasn't this country suffered enough? After 4 years of enduring the desiccated husk of Joe Biden and his upholstery-clad wife, Dr. Mama Jill, being the theoretical president and the first lady of the United States, we should be spared from having to see either one of them in the news. The mainstream media loves to keep the Democrat Party has-beens around, though. We're getting the frequent reminders of them lately. First, Joe's puppet masters are suing the Justice Department to prevent the release of what is bound to be the most embarrassing transcript from interviews with a ghostwriter from his 2027 memoir, whatever the legacy is hoping to preserve is pure work or fiction. Give it up already. The insufferable Ms. Biden's contribution to the news cycle is even more annoying than necessary. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Now, here's the thing. You know, if you're a loving wife or spouse, right, and your spouse is clearly not up for the job, they are, you know, the lights are on and nobody's home, you should basically have, you know, take away the car keys from grandpa, as the case may be. I mean, you know, my family had to take away, before my dad passed away, we had to take away his car keys, and he was not happy. But you know, you did what we had for, you know, you do what you have because you love somebody. And you know, and he was clearly not all there, but you know, they kept saying, and I'm sure Jill Biden was right, might say that now, that you know, Joe Biden could have served another four, he could be president right now. It's like, and does anyone really believe that? You know, you know, the thing is, the irony is that a lot of the people who ignored or, you know, went with the spin that Joe was not senile are now the same people who will jump on any and every verbal flib that Donald Trump might have. Oh, Trump is going senile, despite the fact that Trump is, you know, on public, almost making public appearances every day. In front of the media, in front of a hostile media, where they're asking him real questions as opposed to pre-scripted, pre-selected questions from favorable media outlet sources that are pre-selected by Biden's advance team. I mean, and he's taking hostile questions and he's batting them away left and right, and he's giving the journalists what, you know, right back at him. And without, you know, yeah, he's a little bit on the nasty side, but he's not like the, you know, enraged nasty, you know, that someone with dementia like Joe Biden has. Yeah, but you know, yeah, the same progressives who ignore Joe Biden's obvious senility are now trying to gaslight us, and then Donald Trump is somehow senile or he's losing it. And despite the fact that, you know, he's working, you know, you see him like hours on end and publicly available cabinet meetings with the media present, and then you know, running the meetings as opposed to just like, you know, like Joe just looking, just nodding and bumbling or whatever. And answering hostile media questions, which, you know, Joe Biden hardly ever did, and doing it, you know, with great aplomb, I would say. Let's see here. So, yeah. So, no, we're not going to fall for this gaslight from you, Joe Biden. You know, take your book money and go the F away. You know, you know, and take your idiot's crack smoking hooker banging son Hunter with you. But anyways, now a couple things from the LA mayoral race, which is also oh so fun, is this is from the California Post. Brutal karma for Nithya Rama as she goes ballistic over staged homeless encampment outside her house. This is by Jamie Page, May 28. Socialist LA mayoral candidate Nithya Rama is getting hammered online for appearing visibly rattled by staged homeless encampment protest outside her own home. Quote, I'm glad my kids don't have to see that, Rama told comedian Adam Conover on his podcast released Wednesday before adding, I thought this campaign was going to be about bike lanes and transportation. Now, that last statement of itself should disqualify her, because I mean, you know, really, I mean, you know, there's still a homeless crisis in Los Angeles, housing's still unaffordable, there's several hundred, if not a couple few thousand people who lost their homes in the Pacific Palisades fire, and they're having difficulty rebuilding. There's still a crime problem, you know, there's still you know, cost of living is still ridiculously high, and she thinks it's going to be about bike lanes and transportation. Ninja, please. Now, oh, no, it's too raw. It's too much to stage a homeless encampment. So these are actors, you know, staging a, pretending to be homeless in front of her home in the Tony neighborhood of Silver Lake or whatever, I think is her neighborhood, right? So not a, you know, so living in a $3 million home. Now, these are actors, right? These aren't actual homeless people. So I'm assuming they're not actually urinating. I'm assuming they're not actually defecating in her neighborhood. They're not actually shooting up drugs in her neighborhood. They're actually not masturbating in, well, maybe they're simulating masturbating, but you get the idea, right? So she's upset that these protesters are pretending to be homeless in her neighborhood, where millions of Los Angeles residents actually have homeless people living in their neighborhoods. Maybe the hypocrisy is unbelievably, you know, just hilarious. But, you know, in this case, maybe. Let's see here. Oh, Gavin Newsom apparently has endorsed Karen Bass as for mayor. So good for Karen. I mean, well, I would normally think an endorsement from Gavin Newsom should be the kiss of death in any normal world where everyone knew how bad Gavin Newsom is as governor. But, hey. This is LA. They probably, most people probably think Gavin Newsom's doing a great job, you know, despite the fact that, you know, homelessness went up by a significant amount under his 8 years, despite his comment when he ran for governor. It's like, if the next governor doesn't significantly address solve the problem of homelessness, I would consider it a failure. Well, homelessness got way worse in the 8 years since you became governor. So by his own terms, he is a gigantic failure. But anyways, but on the flip side, this is from Town Hall. This is what Spencer Pratt plans to do with LA's homeless by Dimitri Bolt, May 26. An interesting contrast. What did he say he was going to do? Oh, his plan to address the city's growing homeless crisis includes shipping many of the homeless off to Seattle and putting many in jail as the city's Democrat government has failed to mitigate the issues along the crisis level. He argued that Los Angeles doesn't have an issue with homelessness, but rather an issue of drug addicts and criminals, many of whom simply don't seek the help they offer by the city or state government. As a result, he said many belong in jail while others don't belong in the city at all, having bussed in from what he described as scam rehab centers, nonprofits, and NGOs. I mean, that's true. At least if the city or City Journal org article last week was any accurate, about half the homeless population in Los Angeles does not come from the city of Los Angeles or from Los Angeles County. So bus ride home gets rid of half of them right there. Boom. There you go. And if you get rid of half of LA city's homeless population, that gets you down to about 20 some odd thousand. There are about 15,000 shelter beds, if I'm not mistaken, or AI wasn't lying to me. But so that's a big chunk there. Now, a bunch of these people who are drug addicts who've committed crimes like, you know, shoplifting, indecent exposure, urinating in public, defecating in public, you know, loitering or whatever, those people go to jail. Now, oh, you're just putting them in jail for being homeless. No, you're putting them in jail for committing crimes. And now, while then when they're in jail, now maybe you can give them the whatever services they can that will get, you know, address the underlying root causes. But, you know, that's the way it should be, as the case may be. But anyway, I think we're running out of time here. So, you know, thank you very much for joining me here on the Danger Zone. I hope you'll join me next week. Everyone have a great weekend.